We had the template that every manager wants. I got stick for it. You could see where my mindset was. After the Forest game, we felt there was a real problem there. I was at the match, and I think, you know, Ozzy and I made it clear that we would go in there if they wanted us to go in there. Yeah, Maradona was incredible player. The only reason Paul Gascoigne didn't go was because of his injuries. I had him in every game, in every squad that he was available. He was there for the qualifying games. And the press don't want to hear that, do they? You don't want to go through it. I hated it. The feeling was dreadful. In the 70s, we never qualified for a tournament. It says it all, doesn't it? So, you know, I think we went backwards after winning the World Cup. I never dreamt I was going to go into football management, let alone become England manager.
Hello, welcome to the Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG. Now, if you're of a certain age, our guest today will have been part of your life's footballing journey. As a player, he was often termed naturally gifted. He's unquestionably one of the greatest midfielders ever to come out of England. Of course, he played for his country, though not as often as many people would have wished. And of course, he also went on to manage England. These days, you'll see him as a pundit or hear him as a co-commentator. I'm delighted to welcome Glenn Hoddle to the show. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, Jeff. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Look, that phrase, naturally gifted, you know, and you're also called a luxury player. I just wonder how that sits with you sometimes, because naturally gifted makes it sound to me as if you found things easy. And I'm sure you had to work your socks off to get where you were.
I did, yeah. I mean, I was a natural footballer, yes. You know, I was born that way. I didn't have a choice in many ways, Jeff, but there wasn't even a position for a number 10 back when I played. Everyone was 4-4-2. Bit of a hangover from 66 winning the World Cup. We didn't change our game. We didn't go through the 70s trusting any creative players, really, when you think about it. And so when you were a creative player in England back then, you felt as if you were always fighting against the tide. And that's just how the mentality was with English football.
Yeah. We're going to talk a lot more about your playing days. Mm. But I just want to bring it right to the present, because in recent weeks, Glenn, there have been headlines about Tottenham talking to you about their coach's job, their manager's job, if you like. Was there anything in that?
No, they never came to us. We did, Ozzy and myself, after the Forest game, we felt there was a real problem there. I was at the match, and I think, you know, Ozzy and I made it clear that we would go in there if they wanted us to go in there, you know, and probably with maybe a younger legend as well. It felt as if at that time, at the end of the game, Tudor was in as the manager. To lose 3-0 against, you know, a team that was down the bottom there with you at home was a bad sign. It looked to me as if it needed some love. It needed some people to go in there that was going to unite the fans with the owners and with the team. And that's really why we said we would do it, but it was sort of looked upon, and then they said, well, we're looking elsewhere. So that was fine. That's fine by me. I don't care who. I'm a Spurs man through and through from 8 years of age. So as long as, you know, they've got the right man in, De Zerbi's gone in there, and, you know, everyone's got to unite and get together, but they've got a real task on their hands, haven't they? I just want them to stay up, whether I was involved or I wasn't.
Four managers in a year. I mean, you're a brave man.
Well, no, it's because of the love for the club, really. I mean, I was only a young man. I was, 18 when we went down in the 70s. I was a part of that team, and that hurt me big time. Looking back in my career, it was a big help in many ways. I learned how to deal with negativity and of how to lose before I actually had success. And I think that in football terms, that's quite a good thing. You don't want to go through it. I hated it. The feeling was dreadful to be in a team that, you know, especially as you loved and supported as a kid, and you took, you know, you were a part of a team that went down. That really was difficult for me. But in the long run, it taught me a lot. And when we did get success, it meant so much more. It really did.
I know you say it was Tottenham, but does that tell us that there's still a desire deep down that you want to get back into coaching?
Well, I've never shut the door on coaching, never. But I tell you what I would really love to do. I put my own academy together for young players that were released, and I really enjoyed that. I think the problem we have in football is there is so much experience, talent that goes by and gets lost. You know, you go in other businesses and you say, and they go, well, I'm retired, semi-retired, I do a bit of consultancy in whatever business. We don't do that in football. All the talent, all the experience, everything just goes out of a window and the next generation come through and move in. Whereas never in football do you have a consultancy type of thing. So I would love to work and mentor young players. Some real, I know the journey they're going to have to go on as a player and a manager. And I would love to get some real good talent and a club and mentor them. Because technically I can help them. Tactically, I can help them, as well as the mental side, because sport is about your mental side. They're all good, talented players nowadays, but the difference is what they're going to have to go through mentally. And again, I can help that as well. So I would love to do something like that now.
Why do you think it's been so long that you've not had a coaching role?
I could have gone for different jobs. It's probably because I haven't put my name forward there for so many years. I had a passion to do this academy, and I did that for a little while and loved doing that. And then afterwards, it was some TV. I was doing TV work, as I am now, and I really enjoy that. But I never really thought to myself, well, that's it. I'm going to stop now. I just thought, well, if something comes along that's correct and right, then I'll have a look at it. And I think you're right. I've got, like many people out there, we've got such vast experience and I played the game differently, and I probably played the game closer to how it's being played now in the English game. I was always closer to the continental way of playing, or South American way of playing. And there was a sort of a handful of players in England that played that way. But now, I look at the game now and I think, wow, what a great time for young, creative young players to come through and play now in England. The ball's played on the deck a lot more, and it's more technical. So, and those creative players are they're the ones that people want to talk about. They're the ones that they're not being called a luxury player. You know, for instance, it was always about that back in the 80s. That's how they were. That's how it was. You know, we got to go deep into where we went after we won the World Cup. They didn't trust your Alan Hudsons and your Currys and your Marshes and your Stan Bowles. They couldn't all play together, of course not, but they had two or three caps. And look what happened in the 70s. We never qualified for a tournament. It says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we went backwards after winning the World Cup, and it took a long time. And I was in an era where it took a long, long time for us to change our ways. And fortunately, we did with the academies and the School of Excellences, probably 15 years ago, getting more technical, getting more touches of the ball, changing the rules so that we didn't, you know, play long ball game and big centre forward, centre back, goalkeeper, boot it long. We now played smaller sided pitches, which they've been doing in every country all around the world. We had our head in the sand, to be honest, for a long time.
Yeah. And in your days, obviously your playing days, not just you, but some of the talented players you just mentioned there, they didn't get the protection that players who play that role, for instance, get now. Yeah. And they played on pitches which, you know, you wouldn't contemplate now. Yeah.
I think it's funny when I've shown some people in my family and friends as well, some youngsters, and they see, what is it, the revisited stuff that comes on the telly from the 70s and 80s. And the first thing they say is, wow, look at those pitches. How did you play on them pitches? But the difference was, I suppose, it's like anything else in life. We didn't know any different. We had to get on with it and play on them pitches. But you're right, nowadays they're like carpets. They're absolutely beautiful. And I often say to people, I think I could do a bit of damage on them pitches. So, yeah, it was like that. And you could, some of the games you show these youngsters and they see it and they can't believe their eyes, some of the tackles that go in. And the referee just comes up and shakes his hand and his head and says, no, don't do that again. There's no yellow card even given out. So, it was a brutal game in many ways back then. And you had to, as a youngster coming through, getting in the first team at 17, I very quickly learned, Jeff, that it wasn't just about technique. I was naturally two-footed. I could play with the inside and the outside of my foot. I spent hours after hours playing as a kid against the wall, honing my skills. It was a labour of love.
Is that what Tottenham miss at the moment? I mean, a creative midfield player, somebody to open doors?
I think they do. I don't think it's just Tottenham. I think we have got some really good number 10s that are in the England squad, some lovely creative players. I think Maddison was a big miss for them. He's a creator. And I think Xavi Simons could be a real asset eventually. He's found it hard at the moment. You're hoping that that's a little platform for him now to go and get the confidence. But at the moment, this moment in time, it's not about how pretty Tottenham play or how good they play or how good they perform. It's about winning football matches and holding on to a 2-1 lead sort of thing is more important than the way they played. And if it has to go in rose-ed, it had to go in rose-ed for the last 10 minutes to survive and make sure we're in the Premier League. So that's got to be looked at. But no, I think yeah, there's over the seasons, couple of seasons, you're missing that type of player. The one that can just, even if he's having a quiet game, you know he's got it in his locker just to make a pass that can change the game or a bit of skill and score a goal. Yeah.
Of course, I mean, you had a couple of years in charge at Tottenham, and I read that at the time you thought that Daniel Levy and Joe Lewis hadn't necessarily fully supported you financially. So some Spurs fans would say not much has changed. I know the personnel have, and that neither Daniel or Joe are involved. But 14 permanent managers at Tottenham since you. Mm. What makes it such a difficult job?
Yeah, it's become such a difficult job that should be one of the best jobs in the country, without a doubt. I mean, the facilities that they've got, everything. I just feel over the years that they had a real momentum. They built a lovely team, got to the Champions League final. They needed to build on that. I think they sat back and thought to themselves, well, we're in the Champions League final. We don't need too much, but you do. They did. They needed to really go two or three really top players then, which they probably could have attracted to the club, and shop in Harrods. Go to Harrods to shop. They've never done that since Enoch have taken over. They've never gone top, top, top. And when I said what I said about my situation, I was looking to bring in the likes of a young 21-year-old Eto and an Morientes from Real Madrid. And that would have cost probably 13 million, if I remember, for both of them. And in the end, that didn't happen for whatever reasons. And then in the end, I still got two very good players on a free transfer. Gus Poyet and Teddy Sheringham.
Oh, not bad.
Not bad. In their peak, like these two boys were, that I was trying to get, they would be sensational. They still were great players, but we were shopping in that area. We were free transfers. And that was just my time there. But I think it's also been that they've got a wonderful stadium. We always hear about it. The training ground is off the charts. But unless you've got the squad, you know, everything's there that most people get the squad right. They start winning and, oh, can we build a stadium for them? The training ground. Well, we've done it the other way around, Tottenham. Everything's there ready. What isn't there at the moment is the top, top quality players, maybe two of them, world club, that are really going to take you to another level. The level that stadium deserves, the team that stadium deserves to have. That has never really been the number one priority there. You can say, well, we've spent money, we've done this. Yeah, but there's been a lot of average players come to the club over a long period of time, over them 14 managers, if you like, because that's where you've had to shop. Now, if you can bring players in. Recruitment is so important. Other clubs have done it, the likes of Bournemouth, Brighton. You see what they're Brentford. There's some top quality players. You can still bring them players in. But the emphasis is at Tottenham, that club, the club at how we're set up, how we've tried to make ourselves set up, needs a top quality squad. And that means you have to spend money. And every penny that's made outside of the football club, which is a wonderful thing to do, not many clubs have got what they do. They've got concerts, they've got rugby. If every penny of that's going back into the squad, every fan and every football man will go, happy days. This is the formula, but it hasn't been. And that's where I think there's a dislodgement of some of the stuff, you know, is corporate. It's too corporate. But if that corporate's making your money and it's going back into the football, Tottenham Hotspur is a football club. It's not a concert arena. It's not a boxing arena. It is for one night, or an NFL club. It's a football club. FC. And that's why everything that's on is on the back of Tottenham FC, not the other way around. So every penny should be being spent on the club.
So has it lost its soul a bit?
You only lose your soul if you lose the fans, if the fans become so different. The soul of a club, the building's just a building. But how you get on in that building is that's the soul, that's the energy. I think that's always going to be the same. And I don't think that's changed at Tottenham at all. When I go there, yeah, there's going to be disgruntlement. They've always been a demanding crowd. You know, they have, even when I was a youngster, 17, 18, before, when I was an apprentice, we had some Martin Chivers, Martin Peters, we had some fantastic players, Alan Mullery, young Stevie Perriman. But they would always say, and I was in the crowd as an apprentice or a young schoolboy, give the ball away once, wow, the crowd would be on you, twice, they're on your back. And that was all, I used to think, well, that's just, I don't mind that, that's the standard that they're used to. They were used to the double team in 60s and they'd won things and they'd been the top team in Europe, first team to win a trophy in Europe. So there was, I thought, well, that's the standard you set. And I don't mind that. They've always been a demanding crowd, they really have, but united at the same time. And you just hope that that stays the same. We're in a precarious position at the moment, there's no doubt about it.
I mean, you talk about being an apprentice or being 17 or 18.
Oh, no.
And I'm just looking back at a photo that you brought in there. Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing you'd probably be about that age. You've got a very youthful look. And
a lot of hair, Jeff.
It's a bit Pat Jennings-like, isn't it?
It is a bit Pat. Pat was at the club then. I played with Pat in my debut.
Yeah.
And that would have been when I was about 17, when I've come on against Norwich, actually. Yeah, I think like a bird's nest.
What were your sort of hopes and aspirations then? Did you realise how well it might go for you?
I was there at 11, started training at 11, and every year I went back. And there was over the 11 to 15, there must have been thousands and thousands of kids that come and disappeared. And I was, yeah, you're back next year. See you. So I knew I was doing something good. I was only 11 or 12 and I was training with a 15-year-old. So, you know, physically it was tough, but I knew I was ahead of the station, if you like, my age group. And I had I tore my cartilage when I was 14, complete tore my cartilage, thought my career was over. And Tottenham eventually found out that I'd done my knee and they had me operated on. But I was in doubt. I thought I'd lost my career. I got hit with a cricket ball playing cricket at school when I was round about a similar age, just before. Nearly lost my eyesight. I had a blood clot behind the eye and I had to lay with my head still for 3 weeks in hospital. That would have ruined my career. And then I got overcome that. And then suddenly I kept going back. Yeah, you're coming back again, Glenn. You know, pre-season starts at blah, blah, blah. And I was just a kid, a schoolboy. So I knew I was doing okay. But, Jeff, when you're at a club like Tottenham or any professional club, you really don't know. And they won't let you know. They'll keep your feet on the ground. They might say things behind and about a little in there and, well, what a player he's going to be or whatever. But they don't let you know. You've got to earn your spurs. Excuse the pun, but you've got to go there every year, every session, every training. And that was me. That was the pride I had in my performance. It was incredible, really. When I was a professional, but also when I was a kid. If that ball went under my foot or I'd messed a skill up, that would hurt me deep inside. But what it did, it made me just urge me on to be not perfect, because no one's perfect, but there's nothing wrong with striving to be perfect. And I think that's where you get the best out of you. But that hurt me. That really hurt me, even as a pro. And that's when I was a manager, that's what I would demand from the players. We've all got different levels of skill, but if things like you saw a player repeatedly letting a ball go under it, and all it was concentration, not because I'd be on them, for their own good, you know, and to get the best out of themselves. And that's certainly, when looking back, that's what I always, always was going to get the best out of myself, because I was demanding on myself.
More from Glenn in just a moment, but let me point you in the right direction to do yourself a favour and head to the prizes.olbg.com site. That's prizes.olbg.com, because the team at OLBG have put together some absolute crackers for you. You can win signed shirts from some of the guests we've had on the podcast, I'm telling you some of the names on those shirts that you'll definitely want them on your wall, no question. You can also win a seat in the studio to watch us record an episode, proper behind the scenes stuff, if you like. You'll have the dubious pleasure of meeting me, but you'll also meet the guests as well. Surprises.olbg.com. We'll have all the details in the description for this episode, so make sure you take a look. 18 plus only, of course. T's and C's apply. Free entry route is available. Glenn, look, we touched on that phrase, naturally gifted. Is there anyone around now in the game who you feel is naturally gifted?
Yeah, I would say there's a few, actually. I think De Bruyne is naturally gifted. I think Eze, Arsenal, is a natural player. He looks, again, he's another one in the modern day. They don't get called luxury players, but people would say, as a kid coming through, that kid, a lot of people would have looked at him, coaches looked at him in England and went, not for me. He's too casual. He's too a luxury. But and that's the way he plays. That's his natural way. He looks like he's it's easy to him. And I think that's the difference. I think when you're a natural footballer, things look easy, so people think that you are easy. No. It's the difference between... I like to go down different sports. It's like watching McEnroe play back in the day and Jimmy Connors. Both fantastic players, but Jimmy Connors, it looked like he was putting every bit of ounce of effort into every shot because he had to. He played like that. Whereas McEnroe was just talent, lovely, natural talent. And he just flowed with the way he played. And he looked as if he was running less. He looked as if he was at ease. And I think, you know, that's what a really natural player does. He looks like he's playing in a different motion. He's playing a little bit more time. He's got more time. He's just, that's the difference between a top quality sportsman, really, in many ways. They just look as if they've got more time than anyone else. But some people might think that's a bit easy. He's too easy on himself, or that's just the way he plays. That's his natural way of playing. And I think there are some players like this around at the moment. I think Palmer's like that. Palmer's a natural footballer. What I call a playground footballer. You know, you've got to have the mentality, but sometimes you've got to be... To be a top player in top moments, you have to have a training ground head on. And when I say that, I mean you have to be so relaxed. You don't freeze when you get that opportunity, that split second. You freeze up because it's a big game, it's a big opportunity on the edge of the box. No, you actually relax even more and you play as if it was a training ground, no one watching, bang, curl it in the top corner. If you can, that's what you need to produce in that the mentality of that at that split moment to actually produce the best. And everyone looks and goes, oh, he's a bit too easy. If it doesn't work, they go, oh, he's too easy. It's too. So it's a bit of a conundrum that.
Yeah.
You know, it really is because, and I like to make the analogy of other sports, you know, other sports. And I think people, if they're wrapped up in football, can actually look at that and go, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Because. The McEnroe Connors scenario, you could do it with Alcaraz and Djokovic, actually. You know, they're two different titles, fantastic players. But Alcaraz is just a natural tennis player. And you can see it in football players.
And even if you look at the number 10s, I mean, obviously we're looking at World Cup squads. You look at the number 10s, potential number 10s now. And Eze would be one of them, Cole Palmer would be another. But they're very different players, aren't they, to the likes of Jude Bellingham or Morgan Gibbs-White, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. There's a different style within them tens, you know, and you could put Foden in there, although Foden's not getting enough opportunities at the moment, which is a bit scary. But yeah, you've got different styles of tens, you know, which is also intriguing. How does the manager then mould them together and blend them together? And which style does he go with? Or does he take one for one reason and another for a slightly different reason? Probably that's what he'll want to do because... Any manager wants to balance it off, but yeah, you're right. There's back in the day there was no tens. We didn't have a position for a number 10, but now, because of what I said earlier about the academies changing and the focusing on technique, and you got back players now, back players that can pass the ball. It used to drive me mad when I used to play for England. You know, we'd go and try and get the ball off. Me and Ray Wilkins, we look at each other and just. You know, our heads would go up because it was hit the front, too many teams hit the front, And in international football, you can't give that ball away too easily. And in some ways, technically, I'm not on about character and strength and defending and all that. But I think in international football, particularly back then, even and it would show now, is that you're only as good as your weakest link on the ball. And unfortunately, our centre-backs and sometimes full-backs weren't good enough on the ball. They weren't encouraged to pass the ball into midfield. And they weren't happy doing that. They were happy to go long. And that's how they played in their club team. And that's where we had a real problem back in the 80s. We had some wonderful teams.
Yeah, it was a crying shame because we had some lovely footballers.
We had some wonderful footballers that in the shape nowadays, we could actually, if you think about it, but we were undercoached. We never had somebody that really, really said, right, we're going to play this way, three at the back, maybe flood the midfield, or another way and play one just behind a striker with two wide players, you know. Just off the top of my head, you know, you've got Chrissy Waddle and John Barnes, for instance, two wide men. Look at them now. If they were playing now at this moment in time for most teams coming inside, you had creative players, but we were never really moulded into a team that it suited them. It suited a 4-4-2 and the way England played and the way English football was played back then. So we were way behind coaching-wise.
Which surprises me a bit because, I mean, your England career was what spent under Ron Greenwood and Bobby Robson, yeah, who both got reputations of being great footballing men.
Listen, absolutely. I was shocked. I was surprised. I was really surprised that we didn't do team shape enough. We had not much time together anyway. It was a bit of an eye opener, to be honest. And when I got the England job, I never thought I was going to be England manager. But I thought if ever I got it, because I was a player, I played 53 times. But most of the times we played, we were playing against five in midfield. They'd outnumber us in midfield, and they're all technicians, most teams. And then when we had it, we were outnumbered. We had no options because we were playing 4-4-2 in straight lines. When they had it, they outnumbered us. We were getting run around. And that's why I said, if ever I got that job, I'd make sure that we have three at the back in possession, and then we'd flood the midfield. We'd have five, we'd have the wing backs, and we'd make sure that we have that bolster that midfield and keep our two up front. Because nowadays it's one up front, and then you have to reshape something. But so back then, that's why I did what I did, because I felt it was right for the international scene for England. Other teams could be flexible enough, but we did it. We had to do it because I'd been fed up chasing the ball as an international footballer, and then getting the ball and having perhaps not enough, you know, real good options on the ball. So I learned from my playing days that's how I was going to coach them.
Yeah, we'll talk obviously more about coaching and your coaching career and your spell as manager of England in a moment or two. But talking about brilliant players, technical players. Who was, in your opinion, the best ever? Who's the best you played against?
Oh, without a doubt, it's an easy one. He's a bugger because he called the hand of God. I only got to tell you that, and I think you know who it is. Yeah, Maradona was incredible player. He really was. He was a genius. To play, as you said, on them pitches in an era when they could absolutely kick him left, right and centre, but he was such a strong, talk about strong mentally, he was so strong mentally, he'd just get up and go again. I mean, I say he's the best footballer that I've ever seen. I also say he's one of the best hurdlers I've ever seen, because the amount of times he beats someone and they're trying to chop him, he's jumping a leg, and then he beats the next one and he's jumping a leg. He was incredible. These youngsters, if you're out there listening to this, if you haven't YouTubed him, go and YouTube Maradona. You will be, your breath will be taken away with some of the things he can do skillful-wise on the football pitch in an era when the pitches weren't great and they could kill him. They were trying to kill him. But he was so brave. He used to take every kick, and that would rile him up to play better. But
And here, you know, he is.
Yeah.
In a Tottenham shirt. Yeah, how did you manage that?
Oh, we could do with him today. yeah, that was with Ozzy's testimonial. It was great against Inter Milan at White Hart Lane. Ozzy Ardiles had got him over. That was only, I think, 6 months, something like that, 4 months before the World Cup in 86.
Wow.
Yeah. I should have really sort of smashed his left arm, was it? his left wrist. I should have squeezed it a little bit harder, and perhaps he wouldn't have scored his And a God goal. But no, joking apart, he was sensational.
You were telling me you might have played with him. Might have played with him at Napoli.
Yeah, yeah. I nearly went to Napoli in 82. Wow. He went in 83. I went in 82. But it all got called. Napoli was strange. It's probably missed the bullet there. I think I was all due to go, and the president, I think, ended up in prison. And I think the manager wasn't far from going there as well. So it was all off. So I sort of missed out there. But it would have been interesting if I'd have gone there a year before. I might have ended up playing with Diego, yeah, wow. Which would have been sensational. But, like, you know, listen, sliding doors, isn't it? One door shuts and opens and whatever. But, yeah, it was a good possibility I could have ended up in Napoli.
I tell you, it's... In footballing terms, it's the scariest city I've ever yeah. been to by a long, long way, and the scariest stadium as well. I remember on one trip over there, I was with Graham Souness, actually, and a couple of others. And we're going out for an evening, and a taxi driver drops us at the end of this dark alley. And even yeah. Suey said, we are not walking not down there. Yeah. And we're meeting Gianfranco Zola. I mean, little Gianfranco Zola. Yeah. So we have to call him and say, Franco, can you come up and, help. And help us, take us, walk us down this alleyway? Because it was felt such safe. A
you
scary
felt, you felt safe
place.
With Zola, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It was a bit, I remember right driving around, my wife looking at, we were being driven around, and the traffic alone was like, what yeah. on earth is this place? It was crazy.
Amazing.
But fantastic football supporters and whatever. And in some ways, what Diego did there, they were very, very average team then. They weren't they weren't winning trophies, and they were sort of there or thereabouts, probably sixth, fifth in the league. But for him to go there and do what he did just proves how good he was.
Yeah.
And when they won the World Cup, you know, in 86, the hand of God, you know, when we played against them, the team wasn't a great team. There wasn't that many great players there. He won that. You can't win a tournament on your own. Of course not. It's a team game. It's 11 players. But if ever anyone won it on their own, he won it. He was outstanding. He was incredible, that World Cup.
Brilliant footballer, no question. Yeah. I mean, see, you didn't go to Napoli because you did go to Monaco.
Mm.
With Arsene Wenger, how big a help was that with your career and your subsequent coaching career?
I think on the coachings, I mean, I loved it. I loved it every minute at Monaco. I'd, you know, the car was driving itself to the training ground at Tottenham. I'd been there when I was 11 and I was 28. So I needed to get abroad. I needed to go abroad. Not necessarily in England. I don't think I'd have gone anywhere else at that time, right at the end in England. I would have stayed at Tottenham. But I needed to get abroad and test myself. And ended up at Monaco. Thought I was going to Paris Saint-Germain, but the two clubs couldn't get a deal done. And then Arsene Wenger asked me to go down and talk to him. And I didn't know Arsene at all. Hadn't heard of Arsene. He'd only just taken over. It was his first year at Monaco. Mark Hately had just been signed. And he said, and within 10 minutes of talking to him, I knew I wanted to play for him. The way he was explaining how we would play, how the team would play, you'd be the number 10. And the number 10 is the most important position. And I'm thinking, God, this is music to my ears, this. I've been waiting for this for years. I go to Monaco, really enjoyed it. Win the league the first year we're there, something I didn't do with Tottenham, which I would have loved to have done with my club, but was lucky enough to win the league the first year. We had a great team, played some lovely football. And Arsene was somebody that you just learnt from. And as his coach, totally different to how we were doing things in England and Tottenham. You know, it was just everything holistic about it. It was like your nutrition, what you eat, how you stretch, the amount of time you stretch, massage in England. You'd be kicked out of the dressing room if you asked for a massage. Whereas it was compulsory after a game. Yeah, it was compulsory. You had to have a massage, and the day after, the recuperation, all these things, as well as the tactical side and the training. And then he said to me one day, I remember him, we were stretching. We did about 45 minutes stretching after every session. It was like incredible. But I felt fitter, I've got to say. And he went, have you ever thought about going into coaching, Glenn? You know, I think I had a little joke with him. Said, well, am I not playing well enough for you? And he said, no, after. He said, I think you'd make a good... He said, have a think about it. And I hadn't really thought about that. And I slowly but surely, I then end up with about infected knee, which put me out for about 8 months. So suddenly I thought about what Arsene had said. And I gave myself like a mini sort of apprenticeship of management. I started to look at games with a different view, if I'd have been the manager or if I'd have been the opponent's manager. And I'd watch the game in a different way, as a coach sort of view. So I was giving myself, not knowing I was going to go in that way, I was hoping to get my knee right and stay in Monaco and play again. They offered me a 2-year contract, but I didn't feel right. I knew my knee wasn't right. Didn't know if I was going to play again, so I came home. And ironically, trying to get fit back here, Swindon job came up. They come and asked me out, totally out of the blue. And I went, yeah, why not? So I think Arsene had a real big influence on me. What he did, Jeff, he sowed the seed. He put the seed in there, which wasn't there, you know. And that period of 8 months, you know, when you, for a flower to bloom, you put the seed in, it's got to take some time. And that gave me that time. It gave me that time to look at it differently, with a different eye completely, which was wonderful in the long term. I was desperate to play again, but, you know, didn't play in Monaco.
We've got a picture of your photo of you. There you go.
Yeah.
Different hairstyle again.
Slightly different. Yes, I went really short, actually. I think that was when I first went there. I know by the advertising on the shirt, yeah. But that was when I was there, and then I went really short. It was too hot to have long hair.
And, of course, it was at that time as well that, famously, Michel Platini said that Glenn Hoddle was born as a Frenchman,
yeah.
That had built the entire team around him. It was quite in contrast in attitudes. Mm. You know, just over the channel. I mean, we're not so far away from France.
Honestly,
but a completely different approach.
Totally different, Jeff. Touching on what I said earlier, and I think that was most of the foreign countries. They love even the press. The press, the fans, even people. It was a totally different outlook. They love creative football. They wanted, you know, and the French team that Platini played in the '80s that eventually got over the line and won the Euros. And then obviously what they did, they reinvented it in some ways, in different ways, and they went on and done the World Cup and the Euros even later with more athletic. They had the technique. It was different to what we had. We needed to find the technique and then and let the technique flourish. What they had was they missed out on the mentality side. They missed out on the, you know, the physical side. And they put that together in Bluefontaine, was it? You know, the academy and the excellence. And they built that into their game, which is a little bit easier to do. If you've got the techniques and the abilities, it is easier to put your strength and mentality and teach and do that, change that, than it is the other way. You've either got natural ability or you haven't. That's not going to happen. You'll improve, of course you will. But, you know, they had some wonderful, wonderful flair players, didn't they?
Yeah.
Tigana and Platini, all of them in that era didn't probably win as much as they should have done, and they changed their philosophy a little bit the other way, closer to being a bit more stronger, and they went on and did what they did. So they were always looking at reinventing themselves, like the Germans did. The Germans lost in 66. They dominated in 70, knocked us out in 70, Mexico, and dominated. They won the World Cup. They won the Euros in the 70s. You know what I mean? They totally looked at it and thought, right, we've got to change. And we stood still for a long time. We really did. So the philosophy going across there in France was, and it would have been the same in Spain, Italy, Germany. It was creative. They loved to watch creative football. They loved to see goals scored and number 10s play in the best way they could. Which I absolutely loved. You know, it was lovely to feel that. And the manager, Arsene, said to me, the first game we played, Red Star Belgrade, pre-season game, just a pre-season game. And he said at halftime, I won't do the French accent. I come in at halftime and he went, Glenn, he said, you're coming back too far. Coming back too far. I had battles with McKeith Birkinshaw about, you know, box to box. You've got to be in the box. You've got to defend. And you're coming back too far. He said, we've got two players here behind you. Good players, but they'll win the ball. You're the number 10. You need to be up there. Defend with Mark Hately and defend with the centre forward and the winger. You defend and organise that. Great. But up there, we don't want you coming back. we'll get you the ball. It was like, wow, this is music to my ears. I've been waiting for this for forever. So it was really wonderful. Yeah, it was great. I loved it.
And we touched on the fact that we have some wonderful players now. I mean, there's no question about that. Yet still it seems that we can't make that breakthrough. We can't dominate in the way that, for instance, the French did or the Germans did for us. Is that just the weight of the England shirt, or is it more than that?
I think there's a part of that. There really is. But I think if you've got the weight of the Brazilian shirt or the French shirt now and German shirt, it's no different. It's no different. I think the fact that they have won things that when we haven't, 66 is always going to be on people's shoulders until we actually get over that line. And then that means the Euros as well. We were so close at being at home at Wembley. We'll never get another chance. Better chance, will we? but once that happens, even if it's the Euros, a tournament, if we win a tournament, then I think you'll see, I really believe you could see us really flourish and maybe go on like the French did and dominate a little bit. But the hardest thing is getting over that line first. And that comes at the mental level. We've got some wonderful players. We really have. But they've got to step up and they've got to feel that relaxed and that knowing that they can go in, out there and take on anyone in the world. We're not favourites. There isn't a favourite this World Cup. I don't think so. I think we're one of the favourites that could win it. But I think it's how they go out every single game. If they look, whoever their opponents are, and know that they're better than them. If they have that mental approach, then I think we could go on and win this trophy. Even though it's going to be tough with the heat and possibly more of an advantage for other countries rather than a European country. But a lot of them players are playing in Europe anyway, so that might counteract that a little bit. But it will be tough out there with the heat and everything. But I really think it's even not believing. Knowing you're good enough to win it, there's a difference between, I was having that conversation coming in, there's hoping you're going to win, there's believing you're going to win, and my word, when you know you're going to win, that's a different mentality.
So going into 98, where were you then? Were you hoping we were going to win? Did you believe we were going to win?
I'll answer that in one way, because I got stick for it, but I prepared every hotel right the way to the final. So you could see where my mindset was. Now, the beauty of that, well, not the beauty, the difficulty of that is getting everyone else has got to be on the same song sheet. The players, the staff, everyone, even the backroom staff. Everyone has to have that energy, that belief, and that knowing that we can win this thing. And then if it turns to we're going to win it, that happens during a tournament. I think if we're 10 men, if we not Argentina out with the 10 men, I think that belief would have turned into knowing that we could beat anyone. And then you're going into a different energy. You're going to a different mindset. And that happens during a tournament. So all this stuff about before, do you think we can win it? Then you're going to get asked them questions. Of course you get. But it's what happens during that tournament that can actually define whether there's some negative stuff that happens or there's positive stuff. And if it does, and you can get everyone on board knowing that there's a very good possibility we're going to win this tournament. So my answer was, my mindset was, I said, where's in the final, blah, 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 semi-final, if we go there, you need hotels. We're going to get hotels right the way through. You know, and I was looking at all them things, training grounds, everything, from every round. Because you had to. Why wait? If you're waiting and you're putting your mind in that sort of 50-50 mode, that ain't going to work. You're conning yourself. And I couldn't con myself. I had to be, you know, everything in life doesn't always work out that way, does it? But as long as you set out to achieve them things first, that's what you've got to do. Getting back to ours as a player. You don't want that ball to go under your foot. Yeah. But when it does, it hurts you.
Yeah. You need to be a perfectionist, don't you?
Well, and you learn from it, and you go on.
So look, Thomas Tuchel's picking his England squad. And I mean, how difficult a job is that? I mean, like, I'm asking the right man, obviously, because you know, 30 years on, we still talk about the Gaza decision. But how tough a job will it be for Thomas Tuchel, first of all?
I think he's got a slightly different. I had a bunch of strikers that we haven't got. I had 10 strikers, 9-10 strikers, of which some of them I couldn't get anywhere near the team. People like Andy Cole couldn't get in the school. You know, I had so many good strikers. I think he's got so many number 10s, if you like, that he's got to have to mow. He can't take them all. So I think I can understand. In the end, you've got to look at a balance of a squad. You've got to visualise really what you might need. If you're behind in a game, do I need a different style of player to come on up front to win a game? Last 10 minutes, do we, you know, play a certain way, or do we have to hang on to a team? So you're actually visualising what might happen. But I think you go with the balance. You try to get the right balance of the individual players to play in your system. And I think it's the key one for Tuchel, I think, is going to be that, who does he take in the 10 position? He's got abundance of players. I think that midfield area in the heat as well needs to be the right players. It needs a bit of protection for the back four, because we will come under the cosh against top teams. That's where we haven't gone over that line yet. But then we've got enough creative players. The only problem I feel, I had 9 or 10 players. I had players that I'd mention now and you'd go, oh, wow, I forgot about him. Yeah, you know, Stan Collymore had 2 years. He was outstanding during my England run. Couldn't get him anywhere near the team, really. He played a couple of games, but so if anything happens to Harry Kane, then we're going to be in trouble. Mm. Now, it's asking Harry a lot to play the season he's playing, and that I've seen him in tournaments where he looks tired at the end of a season.
Yeah, well, and that's the last one.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you'd hope that the Bundesliga hasn't taken that, but if he's in the Champions League, if he, you know, mentally and if they get to the final, if they go all the way and they win it, you know, that would be fantastic for him. It would take a lot out of him. But we haven't got two or three that can come in and do his job. So that's where his real, real problem is. And that's the cutting edge part of the pitch. That's when in a tournament, you take your chances. That's where Italy won it in 82. They had a fella called Rossi. They did the press, everyone wanted him out of the team in the first 3 games. But he scored a hat-trick against Brazil, he got them to the final, he won it. That's what we haven't got if Harry goes out of the team. And I'm hoping Harry can keep his form and his freshness during the World Cup as well. We got to give him we got to create the chances for him, because he's a wonderful player.
So you mentioned the tens, you know, who do you take? Who would you take?
My concern for Foden, I love Foden. I think Foden's a fantastic footballer, but he's not getting chances, he's not playing at the moment. That really concerns me. I think Palmer's a special player. So you'd have to choose one of them two. I think it'll take Bellingham. I think Bellingham gives you more than just a 10. He's not really an out-and-out what I call a 10. But I would definitely take Palmer, possibly Foden as well, because Foden's cute enough to play out wide and come in from the wide berth as well as a 10. But he hasn't had enough. I don't know whether Tuchel will look at that and say, you haven't played enough football. I haven't been able to put my hat on you because I haven't seen you. I know what you can do. At the beginning of the season, he was a shoo-in. He was outstanding, Foden, scoring goals. He was brilliant. And he just hasn't had the opportunities at the moment. And I think that's a shame for England. Palmer's had his injury problems. He needs to get back, what I call, on the horse and get back to his very best again before the World Cup and during the World Cup. They're wonderful players, them two. I don't think Eze will go. I don't think he's quite ready yet overall. Wonderful, wonderful player. But I think he likes Rodgers. I think Rodgers is the one that will be the one I think he starts with, actually. How he gets Bellingham into the team with him, I don't know. But that is what I would go with, definitely. I think Palmer has to be in there. Has to be. He's last year he was sensational. What he did and what he can do. Now, when we talk about the number 10s with an England team, you have to go in there and you have to be that real number 10 and be that creator, which Foden hasn't had. And Palmer hasn't had it, really. They don't feel as if they are starters. They feel as if they're on trial every time they play. Now, if you want to be the number 10 and be a creator, you can't play like that. I felt like that every time I played for England. I was out on the right-hand side. It was like, because of the system, really, you felt as if you're on trial every game. You know, I scored in my debut, I scored one, made the other, didn't play for six games. So then when I did come in, it was like, oh, I've got to prove myself again. And I think Foden, for instance, and I think Palmer, they feel as if every time they put an England shirt on, they've got to prove something. You're never, ever going to get the best out of a number 10 doing that. And I think, you know, if Rodgers is the one that he goes with, that's where he's going to say, you're my man. And that will relax him. That will allow him to make a few mistakes. A number 10 has to make a few mistakes. You can't put wonder balls in and you can't score wonder goals every time you're in possession. You will have to make a few mistakes, but it's what happens. Do you know the manager's not going to be concerned about that? Or do you tighten up and get tighter? Well, the tighter you get, the less you go away from being a creative player because you won't take the chance. So it's again, that's the inner player talking here. It's a long time since I played, but that, so he has got loads of options in that position. He really has. And I like that. I like to have that, you know. I think, put it this way, I think Brazil, France, maybe not Spain, Brazil, France, Argentina, they would love to have our five or six options there to say who we're going to pick. They haven't got as many as we've got. And that's some saying, a Brazil team and a French team. They haven't got the options that we've got, you know, real creators.
Does it surprise you that, you know, 30 years on, people like me are still asking about the decision to leave Gascoigne out of that squad in 1998?
No, because it's a simple answer. I think I've answered this with you before, actually. We've spoke about it, and I've said it in many people.
Here you go.
Yeah.
With him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's your sort of player, isn't he?
Absolutely. Gazza would have been in the world. He played in every qualifying game that he was fit. He wasn't fit that year. That was his problem. He was carrying two injuries. And, this is the thing, Jeff. I knew when I was decided that he got a third injury in the last game against Morocco. He had a hematoma, got whacked, had to come off. So he had it. I knew all season he was at Middlesbrough and he had a calf and a knee problem he was nursing. Missed a lot of games, missed a couple of games with us for England. And I remember saying, Gazza, keep yourself fit, but you're leasing the car. They're not yours. They go back to their club. It's like a car you're giving back and then you're taking again. So you're never hands-on. And he was up there at Middlesbrough and he was housing with Merce at the time. You imagine what those two were.
Your dream team.
Well, you can imagine what those two was up to. Anyway, and I said, keep yourself fit, keep yourself fit. But he needed to, it's as simple as that. If he'd have got through that game, and I remember it was a horrible dressing room in Morocco. We had this tournament. We played Morocco the last game before I was going to be, and I said to him, I pulled him aside and I said, I just want to play two touch, play three touch. I just need you to get through 90 minutes, Gazza, with your injuries. Yeah. And he didn't. He dribbled, starts dribbling the ball like he does, a lovely little run. He didn't need to prove anything to anyone. And he gets crocked, and the lads, the treatment next day, how long is it going to be, lads? And they said, well, that's a real bad, you know, it's a bad hematoma. It's going to be 3 weeks at least. And what were the other two? So the only reason Paul Gascoigne didn't go was because of his injuries. I had him in every game, in every squad that he was available. He was there for the qualifying games. And the press don't want to hear that, do they? That was going to mess up their sensational stories. So, and that's how it was. And I looked at it and I thought, well, I brought in a young David Beckham and a young Paul Scholes at the time. Terrific players, wonderful players, still learning. Obviously, they were very young, and I thought, you know, we've got abilities here. We've got some ability here, and it was the saddest decision I've made as a manager. Not the most difficult. It wasn't most difficult.
What was the most difficult?
No, that was like an apprenticeship for me at Swindon, telling six lads that they weren't going to be signed on, and four of them breaking down. I'd only been a manager 6 weeks. That was tough. That was telling them virtually you're not going to be a professional, son. That hurt me as much, well, not as much as them, but, you know, that was horrible. So that was, and I thought to myself after that, I thought, you know what? Like I said about relegation, anything I have to make a decision with going forward as a manager, nothing is going to be like that. So it was actually, it's made it so much easier to make any decision later on. I always cast my mind back. If I had to leave somebody out of a team or whatever, nothing compared to what I experienced there. And I'd only had 6 weeks in the job because it was near the end of the season I took over. And it was, that was tough. That was so tough. So something like that with Paul or anyone, it was nothing compared to that. So it stood me in good stead.
Yeah. People would never have mentioned it again had we gone on and won the tournament, of course.
Of course not, yeah.
And obviously that game against Argentina, everybody talks about the David Beckham sending off, but people forget the sensational Michael Owen goal. Well, maybe they don't forget that, but they forget the Saul Campbell disallowed goal. They remember the battle with the 10 men, you know, against one of the best teams in the world, and how fantastic it was. And, you know, I'm sure you'd have been convinced that if we'd won that game, we'd have probably gone on and won the World Cup.
Well, I think that was the key that I spoke about. I think, could you imagine our belief levels, where they would have gone if we'd have knocked them out? And also, not only that, Jeff, how feared we would have been from other teams, whoever we had to play. They would have gone, wow, that was some performance. So it went to penalties and it didn't go our way. But with 10 men, we went toe-to-toe, and more than toe-to-toe, as you say. Sol scores, he gives a foul against Alan Shearer, not against Sol. And when I look back, the referee with the goal, with the sending off, it's a yellow card. It's not a red card. You know, you don't give a red card for that. It was flippant, but it was a yellow card. So he's made them two big decisions. There was other decisions that I felt were... there was a handball definitely in golden goal, which I saw him put the whistle to his mouth and then take it away because I think he realised it's golden goal. There was a handball on Alan Shearer. Ayala takes it with his hand as Alan, and Alan appeals. No one else appealed. I saw it. And then I'm literally looking at him straight there. And Nielsen, big Danish lad. And he's put the whistle to his mouth and then he's just taken it away. Imagine my heart. Talk about my heart. That was the most emotional game I've ever been involved in. The ups and downs, the roller coaster of what we achieved, what we thought we'd achieved, and then suddenly going to it was incredible.
Yeah,
it was an incredible game.
It could have changed the future of football in this country. It could have certainly changed your future as well. I have to ask you: do you ever regret taking the England job? Because we know how it ended and how difficult that was for you.
You know what? I probably actually foresee it a little bit in the way that I was asking the question, should I take it? So fast forward that 2 years in before, I sat and thought about it on my own and then I spoke to my family. But I came round to the conclusion that it's the most wonderful job you can have with the cream of the country to coach, going into possibly a World Cup. We hadn't qualified then. Going to a World Cup. I played in the World Cup. I'd watched it as a kid. I watched it in 60. You know, all them things were going through my mind. To go against the best in the world, the best coaches and that. I was still relatively, well, I was young, very young. But the football side, I'd had no fears about taking it through the football side. I was excited about, I had a passion for football, but I was excited about taking on... having Shearer, Ince's, David Seaman, all these players. Wow, the cream of the country. And then I said to myself, the only reason, what about the press? There's going to be pressure on my family, there's going to be pressure on me. But I can cope with the football pressure, it doesn't concern me. But there might be some crap that goes with it. I'd seen it with managers, obviously. Seen it myself. Being a player with Bobby Robson and then obviously Graham. Every England manager has had sort of some sort of... outside football stick, put it that way, which is wrong, which is other countries don't do that. If it's football, sack him, get him, rid of him because you're not winning football matches. But I summed that all up and I thought, you know what? That is not, Glenn, that is not a reason to turn your country down in a sport that is passionate, that you love. Why would you turn it down? Because you were going to fear what they might do or what they blah, blah, blah. So that was my... that was my reason saying, I'll take it and I would do it again tomorrow. But ironically, that's what happened. It wasn't for football reasons why the press turned on me in many ways. So it was almost like foreseen a little bit of what was going to possibly happen, but I shoved that out of my mind. You know, I said, that's not a reason. It's not a reason, Glenn, to turn your country down. And if I turned it down for that reason, and it was offered for me in 10 years later, I'd have had to turn it down again because I wouldn't have been being true to myself. So I summed all them things up and thought, no, this is exciting. This is why I never dreamt I was going to go into football management, let alone become England manager, you know, and it's just the way the path went for me. And I took that. I could have said no to Swindon. I hadn't done one coaching session before I took over at Swindon. I did a coaching session when I was 17, apprentice, 15, 16. We did our course of FA coaching thing. We did 6 weeks of coaching there when I was a kid, but that was just like prelim badge. But I'd never took a session at all. So I could have easily gone, no, not for me. No, it's not. No thanks. But I didn't. I just went, no, that's my next step in life, you know. And that's how I looked at it. So I think we were very close. I mean, the frustrating thing people say about, do you, you know, regret or you bitter? No. Frustration. Because, Jeff, we had the template. We had the template that every manager wants. Very good players, experience and young. We had still Shearers and your Sheringhams and your Inces and your Adams and your Seaman. And we had a Beckham. We had a Scholes. We had a Rio Ferdinand. We had a Michael Owen. They're just talking now, just those off the top
great
of my
names.
Head. You just put them together. That's the balance and that's the template any manager would want.
Yeah.
All good players, all very good players. And gel them together. And I think we could have gone, I really do believe, you know, if that result goes another way, it was a titanic performance, as the one in Rome was to qualify.
Yeah.
To go in their own backyard unbeaten and do what we did there was sensational. So I knew that we had a team, actually, I felt, that people feared. We played differently. We had three at the back constantly, and we played through the pitch, through the lines, as they say nowadays, and we had a flair as well as a bit of strength as well about us. So we had a solid back three at times, but they could use the ball in the end. But, you know, so it was where we could have gone with that team, we'll never know. But it's easy to say that. But I know in my heart and my head, the vision that I had, for instance, Rio Ferdinand. Rio is a fantastic centre-half, yeah? Fantastic footballing centre-half. Never really got a chance to show how good he could have been in a three. Played always in a club side that had a four. And you can't come out in the midfield like I had him playing. My last game actually was against Czech Republic. And he was sweeper and he was coming into midfield. And if Ince would drop in, if, you know, we had it off to a tee. But he would have just encouraged that. I mean, he would have been like a German sweeper, like you see the Germans play, where he'd go into midfield with or without the ball and make the difference. Because he could use the ball. We never really, I've often had chats with him when we're doing TV back in a few years ago. He would have been able to really flourish even more so, and which would have given us another dimension to the team. And all them things were in my mind thinking, that's how frustrating it's been, because all them things went out the window.
Listening to your talk, Glenn, and so passionate. That's why I know we need you back in the game. That's absolutely it. Look, time's beaten us, so just sing us out with a chorus of Diamond Lights, would you?
Oh, dear. Well, I thought I got away with that without asking that. It's the first.
Glenn, as ever, thank you very much indeed, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure. You've been watching The Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG.